ISIS Audio Books presents an unabridged recording of The Fifth Elephant, written by Terry Pratchett, read by Stephen Briggs. They say the world is flat and supported on the back of four elephants, who themselves stand on the back of a giant turtle. They say that the elephants, being such huge beasts, have bones of rock and iron, and nerves of gold for better conductivity over long distances. Not rock and iron in a dead form, as they are now, but living rock and iron. The dwarfs have quite an inventive mythology about minerals. They say that the fifth elephant came screaming and trumpeting through the atmosphere of the young world all those years ago and landed hard enough to split continents and raise mountains. No one actually saw it land, which raised the interesting philosophical question. When millions of tons of angry elephant come spinning through the sky, and there's no one to hear it, does it, philosophically speaking, make a noise? And if there was no one to see it hit, did it actually hit? In other words, wasn't it just a story for children to explain away some interesting natural occurrences? As for the dwarfs, whose legend it is, and who mine a lot deeper than other people, they say that there is a grain of truth in it. On a clear day, from the right vantage point on the ramtops, a watcher could see a very long way across the plains. If it was high summer, they could count the columns of dust as the ox trains plodded on at a top speed of 2 miles an hour, each pair pulling a train of two wagons carrying 4 tons apiece. Things took a long time to get anywhere, but when they did, there was certainly a lot of them. To the cities of the Circle Sea, they carried raw material, and sometimes people who were off to seek their fortune and a fistful of diamonds. To the mountains they brought manufactured goods, rare things from across the oceans, and people who had found wisdom and a few scars. There was usually a day's travelling between each convoy. They turned the landscape into an unrolled time machine. On a clear day, you could see last Tuesday. Heliographs twinkled in the distant air as the columns flashed messages back and forth about bandit presence, cargoes, and the best place to get double egg, treble chips, and a steak that overhung the plate all round. Lots of people travelled on the carts. It was cheap, it beat walking, and you got there eventually. Some people travelled for free. The driver of one wagon was having problems with his team. They were skittish. He'd expect this in the mountains, where all sorts of wild creatures might regard the oxen as a travelling meal, but here there was nothing more dangerous than cabbages. Behind him, down in a narrow space between loads of cut lumber, something slept. It was just another day in Ankh Morpork. Sergeant Colon balanced on a shaky ladder at one end of the brass bridge, one of the city's busiest thoroughfares. He clung by one hand to the tall pole with the box on top of it, and with the other he held up a homemade picture book to the slot in front of the box.
"And this is another sort of cart," he said. "Got it?"
"Yes,"
said a very small voice from within the box.
"Okay,"
said Colon, apparently satisfied. He dropped the book and pointed down the length of the bridge.
"Now, you see those two markers what has been painted across the cobbles?"
"Yes."
"And they mean?"
"If a cart goes between them in less than a minute, going too fast,"
the little voice parroted.
"Well done. And then you—"
"Paint a picture."
"Taking care to show—"
"Driver's face or cart license."
"And if it's night's time, you—"
"Used a salamander to make it bright."
"Well done, Rodney. And one of us will come along every day and collect your pictures. Got everything you want?"
"Yes."
"What's that, Sergeant?"
Colon looked down at the very large, brown, upturned face and smiled.
"Afternoon, all," he said, climbing ponderously down the ladder. "What you are looking at, Mr. Jolson, is the modern watch for the Lumillennium.
"It's a bit big, Fred," said old Jolson, looking at it critically. "I've seen lots of smaller ones."
"Watch as in city watch, all."
"Ah, right.
Anyone goes too fast round here, and Lord Veterinary'll be looking at his picture next morning. The iconographs do not lie, all."
"Right, Fred. "'cause they're too stupid.'
"'His lordship's got fed up with carts speeding over the bridge, see, "'and asked us to do something about it. "'I'm head of traffic now, you know. "'Is that good, Fred?'
"'I should just think so,' said Sergeant Colon expansively. "'It's up to me to keep the, arteries of the city from clogging up, "'leading to a complete breakdown of commerce and ruination for us all. "'Most vital job there is, you could say.'
"'And it's just you doing it, is it?'
"'Well, mainly. "'Corporal Nobbs and the other lads help, of course.'
"'All Jolson scratched his nose.
"'It was on a similar subject that I wanted to talk to you, Fred,' he said. "'No problem, all. "'Something very odd's turned up outside my restaurant, Fred.'
"'Sergeant Colon followed the huge man round the corner. "'Fred usually liked All's company because... Next to All, he was very skinny indeed. All Jolson was a man who'd show up on an atlas and change the orbit of small planets. Paving stones cracked under his feet. He combined in one body, and there was plenty of room left over, Ankh-Morpork's best chef and its keenest eater. A circumstance made in mashed potato heaven. Sergeant Colon couldn't remember what the man's real first name had been. He'd picked up the nickname by general acclaim, since no one seeing him in the street for the first time could believe that it was All Jolson. There was a big cart on Broadway. Other traffic was backed up, trying to manoeuvre round it.
"'Had my meat delivered at lunchtime, Fred, and when my carter came out,'
All Jolson pointed to the large triangular construction locked around one wheel of the cart. It was made of oak and steel, with yellow paint sloshed over it. Fred tapped it carefully.
"'I can see where your problem is right here,' he said. "'So how long was your carter in there?' "'Well, I gave him lunch. "'And very good lunches you do, All, I've always said. "'What was he special today?' "'Smitten steak with cream sauce and slumpy, "'and black death meringue to follow,' said All Jolson.
There was a moment of silence as they both pictured this meal. Fred Colon gave a little sigh.
"'Butter on the slumpy?'
"'You wouldn't insult me by suggesting I'd leave it off, would you?'
"'A man could linger a long time over a meal like that,' said Fred. "'The trouble is, the patrician All gets very short about carts parking on the street for more than 10 minutes. He reckons that's a sort of crime.
"'Taking 10 minutes to eat one of my lunches isn't a crime, Fred. It's a tragedy,' said All. "'It says here... City Watch, $15 removal, Fred. That's a couple of days' profits, Fred.
Thing is, said Fred Colon, it'll be paperwork, see? I can't just wave that away. I only wish I could. There's all them counterfoils on the spike in my office. If it was me running the watch, of course. But my hands are tied, see?
The two men stood some way apart, hands in pockets, apparently paying little attention to one another. Sergeant Colon began to whistle under his breath.
"'I know a thing or two,' said All carefully. "'People think waiters ain't got ears.'
"'I know lots of stuff, All,'
said Colon, jingling his pocket's change. Both men stared at the sky for a while.
"'I may have some honey ice cream left over from yesterday.'
Sergeant Colon looked down at the cart.
"'Here, Mr. Jolson,' he said, in a voice of absolute surprise. "'Some complete bastard's put some kind of clamp on your wheel. "'Well, we'll soon see about that.'
Colon pulled a couple of round, white-painted paddles from his belt, sighted on the watch-house semaphore tower peeking over the top of the old lemonade factory, waited until the watching gargoyles signalled him, and with a certain amount of verve and flair, ripped off an impression of a man with stiff arms playing two games of table tennis at once.
"'The team will be along any minute. Ah, watch this.'
A little further along the street, two trolls were carefully clamping a hay wagon. After a minute or two, one of them happened to glance at the watch-house tower, nudged his colleague, produced two bats of his own, and, with rather less élan than Sergeant Colon, sent a signal. When it was answered, the trolls looked around, spotted Colon, and lumbered towards him.
"'Ta-da!'
said Colon proudly.
"'Amazing, this new technology,' said Old Jolson admiringly, "and they must have been, what, 40 or 50 yards away?"
"Three all. In the old days I'd have had to blow a whistle, and they'll arrive here knowing it was me who wanted them, too."
"Instead of having to look and see it was you," said Jolson.
"Well, yeah," said Colon,
aware that what had transpired might not be the brightest ray of light in the new dawn of the communications revolution.
"Of course, it would have worked just as well if they'd been streets away, on the other side of the city even. And if I told the gargoyle to, as we say, put it on the big tower over on the Tump, they'd have got it in Stolet within minutes, see?"
"And that's 20 miles,
at least."
"Amazing, Fred."
"Time moves on, all," said Colon, as the trolls reached them. "Constable Chert, who told you to clamp my friend's cart?" he demanded.
"Well, Sarge, this morning you said we was to clamp every—"
"Not this cart," said Colon. "Unlock it right now, and we'll say no more about it, eh?"
Constable Chert seemed to reach the conclusion that he wasn't being paid to think. And this was just as well, because Sergeant Colon did not believe trolls gave value for money in that department.
"If you say so, Sarge."
"While you're doing that, me and all here will have a little chat, right, all?" said Fred Colon.
"That's right, Fred."
"Well, I say chat, but I'll be mostly listening on account of having my mouth full."
Snow cascaded from the fir branches. The man forced his way through, stood fighting for breath for a moment, and then set off across the clearing at a fast trot. Across the valley, he heard the first blast on the horn. He had an hour then, if he could trust them. He might not make it to the tower, but there were other ways out. He had plans. He could outwit them. Keep off the snow as much as you can, double back, make use of the streams. It was possible. It had been done before. He was sure of that. A few miles away, sleek bodies set out through the forest. The hunt was on. Elsewhere in Ankh-Morpork, the Fool's Guild was on fire. This was a problem, because the Guild's fire brigade consisted largely of clowns. And this was a problem, because if you show a clown a bucket of water and a ladder, he only knows one way to act. Years of training take over. It's something in the red nose speaking to him. He can't help himself. Sam Vimes of the Ankh-Morpork City Watch leaned against a wall and watched the show.
"We really must put that proposal for a civic fire service to the petition again," he said.
Across the street a clown picked up a ladder, turned, knocked the clown behind him into a bucket of water, then turned again to see what the commotion was, thus sending his rising victim into the bucket again with a surprising parping noise. The crowd watched silently. If it was funny, clowns wouldn't be doing it.
"The guilds are all very much against it," said Captain Carrot
Iron Founderson, his second in command, as the clown with the ladder had a bucket of water poured down his trousers.
"They say it'll be trespass."
The fire had taken hold in a first-floor room.
"If we let it burn, it'll be a blow for entertainment in this city," said Carrot earnestly.
Vimes looked sideways at him. That was a true Carrot comment. It sounded as innocent as hell, but you could take it a different way.
"It certainly would," he said. "Nevertheless, I suppose we'd better do something."
He stepped forward and cupped his hands.
"All right, this is the watch. Bucket chain," he shouted.
"Oh, must we?" said someone in the crowd.
"Yes, you must," said Captain Carrot. "Come on, everyone. If we form two lines, we'll have this done in no time at all. What do you say, eh? It might even be fun."
And they did it, Vimes noted. Carrot treated everyone as if they were jolly good chaps, and somehow, in some inexplicable way, they couldn't resist the urge not to prove him wrong. And to the disappointment of the crowd, the fire was soon put out, once the clowns were disarmed and led away by kind people. Carrot reappeared, wiping his forehead, as Vimes lit a cigar.
"Apparently the fire-eater was sick," he said.
"It's just possible we might never be forgiven," said Vimes, as they set off on patrol again. "Oh, no, what now?"
Carrot was staring upwards towards the nearest Clax Tower.
"Riot in Cable Street," he said. "It's all officers, sir."
They broke into a run. You always did for an all-officers. The people in trouble might well be you. There were more dwarfs on the streets as they got nearer, and Vimes recognised the signs. The dwarfs all wore preoccupied looks and were walking in the same direction.
"It's over," he said as they ran to the corner. "You can tell by the sudden increase of suspiciously innocent bystanders."
Whatever else the emergency had been, it had been a big one. The street was strewn with debris and a fair amount of dwarfs. Vimes slowed down.
"Third time this week," he said. "What's got into them?"
"Hard to say, sir," said Carrot.
Vimes shot him a glance. Carrot had been raised by dwarfs. He also, if he could possibly avoid it, never told a lie.
"That isn't the same as I don't know, is it?"
he said. The captain looked awkward.
"I think it's sort of political," he said.
Vimes noted a throwing axe buried in a wall.
"Yes, I can see that," he said.
Someone was coming along the street, and was probably the reason why the riot had broken up. Lance Constable Bluejohn was the biggest troll Vimes had ever met. He loomed. He was so big that he didn't stand out in the crowd because he was the crowd. People failed to see him because he was in the way. And like many overgrown people, he was instinctively gentle and rather shy and inclined to let others tell him what to do. If fate had led him to join a gang, he'd be the muscle. In the watch, he was the riot shield. Other watchmen were peering around him.
"Looks like it started in Gimlet's delicatessen," said Vimes, as the rest of the watch moved in. "Get a statement of Gimlet."
"Not a good idea, sir," said Carrot firmly. "He didn't see anything."
"How do you know he didn't see anything? You haven't asked him."
"I know, sir. He didn't see anything. He didn't hear anything either."
"With a mob trashing his restaurant and scrapping the street outside?"
"That's right, sir."
"Ah, I get it. There's none so deaf as those that won't hear, are you saying?"
"Something like that, sir, yes. Look, it's all over, sir. I don't think anyone's seriously hurt. It'll be for the best, sir, please."
"Is this one of those private dwarf things, Captain?"
"Yes, sir."
"Well, this is Ankh-Morpork, Captain, not some mine in the mountains, and it's my job to keep the peace. And this, Captain, doesn't look like it. What are people going to say about rioting in the streets?"
"They'll say it's another day in the life of the big city, sir," said Carrot woodenly.
"Yeah, I suppose they would at that. However," Vimes picked up a groaning dwarf, "who did this?" he demanded. "I'm not in the mood for being messed around. Come on, I want a name."
"Aggie Hammer Thief,"
muttered the dwarf, struggling.
"All right," said Vimes, letting him go. "Write that down, Carrot."
"No, sir," said Carrot.
"Excuse me?"
"There is no Aggie Hammer Thief in the city, sir."
"You know every dwarf?"
"A lot of them, sir. But Aggie Hammer Thief is only found down mines, sir. He's a sort of mischievous spirit, sir. For example, put it where Aggie puts the coal, sir, means—"
"Yes, I can guess," said Vimes. "You're telling me that that dwarf just said that this riot was started by Sweet Fanny Adams."
The dwarf had disappeared smartly round a corner.
"More or less, sir."
"Excuse me a moment, sir."
Carrot stepped across the street, pulling two white-painted paddles out of his belt.
"I'll just get a line of sight on a tower," he said. "I'd better send a clax."
"Why?"
"Well, we've kept the patrician waiting, sir, so it'd be good manners to let him know we're late."
Vimes pulled out his watch and stared at it. It was turning out to be one of those days, the sort you got every day. It is in the nature of the universe that the person who always keeps you waiting 10 minutes will, on the day you are 10 minutes tardy, have been ready 10 minutes early and will make a point of not mentioning this.
"Sorry we're late, sir," said Vimes as they entered the oblong office.
"Oh, are you late?" said Lord Vetinari, looking up from his paperwork. "I really hadn't noticed. Nothing serious, I trust."
"The Fool's Guild caught fire, sir," said Carrot.
"Many casualties?"
"No, sir."
"Well, that is a blessing," said Lord Vetinari carefully.
He put down his pen. "Now, what do we have to discuss?" He pulled another document towards him and read it swiftly.
"Ah, I see that the new traffic division is having the desired effect."
He indicated a large pile of paper.
"I am getting any amount of complaints from the Carters and Drovers Guild. Well done. Do pass on my thanks to Sergeant Colon and his team."
I will, sir.
I see in one day they clamped 17 carts, 10 horses, 18 oxen, and 1 duck.
It was parked illegally, sir.
Indeed. However, a strange pattern seems to emerge.
Sir?
Many of the carters say that they were not, in fact, parked, but had merely halted while an extremely old and extremely ugly lady crossed the road extremely slowly.
That's their story, sir.
They know she was an old lady by her constant litany on the lines of, "Oh, dearie me, my poor old feet," and similar expressions.
"Certainly sounds like an old lady to me, sir," said Vimes,
his face wooden. "Quite so. What is rather strange is that several of them then report seeing the old lady, subsequently legging it away along an alley rather fast. I discount this, of course, were it not for the fact that the lady has apparently been seen crossing another street, very slowly, some distance away shortly afterwards. Something of a mystery, Vimes."
Vimes put his hand over his eyes. "It's one I intend to solve quite quickly, sir."
Patricia nodded and made a short note on the list in front of him. As he went to move it aside, he uncovered a much grubbier, much folded scrap of paper. He picked up 2 letter knives and, using them fastidiously, unfolded the paper and inched it across the desk towards Vimes.
"Do you know anything about this?" he said.
Vimes read in large, round, crayoned letters,
"The cruelty to homeless dogs in this city is a disgrace. What are the watch do ing a bout it? Signed, the leak against cruel tea to dogs."
"Not a thing," he said.
"My clerks say that one like it is pushed under the door most nights," said the patrician. "Apparently no one is seen."
"Do you want me to investigate?" said Vimes. "It shouldn't be hard to find someone in this city who dribbles when he writes and spells even worse than Carrot."
"Thank you, sir," said Carrot.
"None of the guards report noticing anyone," said the patrician. "Is there any group in Ankh-Morpork particularly interested in the welfare of dogs?"
"I doubt it, sir."
"Then I shall ignore it, pro tem," said Vetinari. He let the soggy letter splash into the waste paper basket. "On to more pressing matters," he said briskly. "Now then, what do you know about Bonk?" Vimes stared. There was a polite cough from Carrot.
"The river or the town, sir?" he said.
The patrician smiled. "Ah, Captain, you have long ago ceased to surprise me. Yes, I was referring to the town."
"It's one of the major towns in Oberwald, sir," said Carrot. "Exports, precious metals, leather, timber, and, of course, fats from the deep fat mines at Schmalzberg."
"There's a place called Bonk," said Vimes,
still marvelling at the speed with which they'd got here from a damp letter about dogs.
"Strictly speaking, sir, it's more correctly pronounced Bionk," said Carrot.
"Even so.
And in Bionk, sir, Morpork sounds exactly like their word for an item of ladies' underwear," said Carrot. "There's only so many syllables in the world when you come to think about it."
"How do you know all this stuff, Carrot?"
"Oh, you pick it up, sir, here and there."
"Really? So exactly which item of—"
"Something extremely important will be taking place there in a few weeks," said Lord Vetinari.
"Something which, I have to add, is vital to the future prosperity of Ankh-Morpork."
"The crowning of the Low King," said Carrot.
Vimes stared from him to the patrician and back again.
"Is there some kind of circular that goes around which doesn't get as far as me?" he said. "The dwarf community has been talking about little else for months, sir."
"Really?" said Vimes.
"You mean the riots? Those fights every night in the dwarf bars?"
"Captain Carrot is correct, Vimes. It will be a grand occasion, attended by representatives of many governments. and from various Oberwald principalities, of course, because the Low King only rules those areas of Oberwald that are below ground. His favour is valuable. Borogravia and Genua will be there, without a doubt, and probably even Klatsch.
Klatsch? But they're even further from Oberwald than we are. What are they bothering to go for?
He paused for a moment and then added,
Ha, I'm being stupid. Where's the money?
I beg your pardon, Commander?
That's what my old sergeant used to say when he was puzzled, sir. Find out where the money is, and you've got it half solved.
Vetinari stood up and walked over to the big window with his back to them. A large country, Oberwald, he said, apparently addressing the glass. Dark, mysterious, ancient.
Huge untapped reserves of coal and iron ore, said Carrot. And fat, of course. The best candles, lamp oils and soap come ultimately from the Schmalzberg deposits.
Why? We've got our own slaughterhouse, haven't we?
Ankh-Morpork uses a great many candles, sir.
It certainly doesn't use much soap, said Vimes.
There are so many uses for fats and tallow, sir, we couldn't possibly supply ourselves.
Ah, said Vimes. The patrician sighed. Obviously I hope that we may strengthen our trading links with the various nations within Oberwald, he said. The situation there is volatile in the extreme. Do you know much about Oberwald, Commander Vimes?
Vimes, whose knowledge of geography was microscopically detailed within 5 miles of Ankh-Morpork, and merely microscopic beyond that, nodded uncertainly.
Only that it's not really a country, said Vimes. It's rather more what you get before you get countries, said Carrot. It's mainly fortified towns and fiefdoms, with no real boundaries and lots of forest in between. There's always some sort of feud going on. There's no law apart from whatever the local lords enforce, and banditry of all kinds is rife.
So unlike the home life of our own dear city, said Vimes, not quite under his breath. The patrician gave him an impassive glance.
In Oberwald, the dwarfs and trolls haven't settled their old grievances, Carrot continued. There are large areas controlled by feudal vampire or werewolf clans, and there are also tracts with much higher than normal background magic. It is a chaotic place indeed, and you'd hardly think you're in the century of the fruit bat. It is to be hoped that things will improve, however, and Oberwald will happily be joining the community of nations.
Vimes and Vetinari exchanged looks. Sometimes Carrot sounded like a civics essay written by a stunned choir boy.
Well put, said the patrician at last, but until that joysome day, Oberwald remains a mystery inside a riddle wrapped in an enigma.
Let me see if I've got this right, said Vimes. Oberwald is like this big suet pudding that everyone suddenly noticed, and now with this coronation as an excuse, we've all got to rush there with knife, fork and spoon to shovel as much on our plates as possible.
Your grasp of political reality is masterly, Vimes. You lack only the appropriate vocabulary. Ankh-Morpork must send a representative, obviously. An ambassador, as it were.
You're not suggesting I should go to this affair, are you? Said Vimes.
Oh, I couldn't send the commander of the city watch, said Lord Vetinari. Most of the Oberwald countries have no concept of a modern civil peacekeeping authority.
Vimes relaxed. I'm sending the Duke of Ankh instead. Vimes sat bolt upright.
They are mostly feudal systems, Vetinari went on. They set great store by rank.
I'm not being ordered to go to Oberwald.
Ordered, Your Grace?
Vetinari looked shocked and concerned. Good heavens, I must have misunderstood Lady Sybil. She told me yesterday that a holiday a long way from Ankh-Morpork would do you the world of good.
You spoke to Sybil?
At the reception for the new president of the Tailors' Guild, yes. I believe you left early. You were called away. Some emergency, I understand. Lady Sybil happened to mention how you seemed to be, as she put it, constantly on the job, and one thing led to another. Oh, dear, I do hope I haven't caused some marital misunderstanding.
I can't leave the city now, of all times, said Vimes desperately. There's so much to do.
That is exactly why Sybil says you ought to leave the city, said Vetinari.
But there's the new training school.
Ticking over nicely now, sir, said Carrot.
The old carrier pigeon network is a complete mess. More or less sorted out, sir, now we've changed their feed. Besides, the clax seems to be functioning very well. We've got to get the river watch set up. Can't do much for the week or two, sir, until we've dredged up the boat. The drains at the Chitling Street station are... I've got the plumbers working on it, sir.
Vimes knew he had lost. He had lost as soon as Sybil was involved, because she was always a reliable siege engine against the walls of his defences. But there was such a thing as going down fighting.
"You know I'm no good at diplomatic talk," he said.
"On the contrary, Vimes, you appear to have amazed the diplomatic corps here in Ankh-Morpork," said Lord Veterinary. "They're not used to plain speech. It confuses them. What was it you said to the Istanzian ambassador last month?" He riffled through the papers on his desk. "Let me see, the complaint is here somewhere. Oh, yes, on the matter of military incursions across the Slipnir River, you indicated that further transgressions would involve him personally, that is to say the ambassador, and I quote, going home in an ambulance."
"I'm sorry about that, sir, but it had been a long day, and he was really getting on my..."
"Since when? Their armed forces have pulled back so far that they are nearly in the next country," said Lord Veterinary, moving the paper aside. "I have to say that your observation complied only with the general thrust of my view in this matter, but was at least succinct. Apparently, you also looked at the ambassador in a very threatening way."
"It was only the way I usually look."
"To be sure. Happily, in Uberwald, you will only need to look friendly."
But you don't want me saying things like, 'How about selling us all your fat really cheap, do you?'"
said Vimes desperately. "You will not be required to do any negotiating, Vimes. That will be dealt with by one of my clerks, who will set up the temporary embassy and discuss such matters with his opposite numbers among the courts of Uberwald. All clerks speak the same language. You will simply be as ducal as you can, and of course you will take a retinue." "A staff," Veterinary added, seeing Vimes's blank look. He sighed. "People to go with you. I suggest Sergeant Angua, Sergeant Detritus, and Corporal Littlebottom."
"Ah!"
said Carrot, nodding encouragingly.
"Sorry," said Vimes. "I think there must have been a whole piece of conversation just then that I must have missed."
"A werewolf, a troll, and a dwarf," said Carrot. "Ethnic minorities, sir."
"But in Uberwald they are ethnic majorities," said Lord Veterinary. "All three officers come from there originally, I believe. Their presence will speak volumes."
"So far it hasn't sent me a postcard," said Vimes. "I'd rather take—"
"Sir, it will show people in Uberwald that Ankh-Morpork is a multicultural society, you see," said Carrot.
"Oh, I see. People like us. People you can do business with," said Vimes glumly.
"Sometimes," Veterinary said testily, "it really does seem to me that the culture of cynicism in the watch is
insufficient," said Vimes.
There was a silence.
"All right," he sighed. "I'd better go off and polish the knobs on my coronet, hadn't I?"
"The ducal coronet, if I remember my heraldry, does not have knobs on. It is decidedly spiky," said the patrician, pushing across the desk a small pile of papers topped by a gold-edged invitation card.
"Good.
I will have a clax sent immediately. You will be more fully briefed later. Do give my regards to the Duchess. And now, please do not let me detain you further."
"He always says that," muttered Vimes, as the two men hurried down the stairs. "He knows I don't like being married to a Duchess. I thought you and Lady Sybil—"
"Oh, being married to Sybil is fine, fine," said Vimes hurriedly.
"It's the Duchess bit I don't like.
Where is everyone tonight?"
"Corporal Littlebottom's on pigeon duty, Detritus is on night patrol with Swires, and Angua's on special duty in the shade, sir. You remember, with Nobby."
"Oh, gods, yes. Well, when they come in tomorrow, you'd better get them to report to me. Incidentally, get that bloody wig off Nobby and hide it, will you?"
Vimes leafed through the paperwork.
"I've never heard of the low king of the dwarfs. I thought that king in dwarfish just meant a sort of senior engineer."
"Ah, well, the low king is rather special," said Carrot.
"Why?"
"Well, it all starts with the scone of stone, sir."
"The what?"
Would you mind a little detour on the way back to the yard, sir? It'll make things clearer.
Thank you.